You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer-powered.
Listener-supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community. And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon. From the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Todd Wicks. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, April 16th, 2019.
Any affordable housing project requires several layers of funding. It's just the way building it works. And so we're delighted to have several partners for this project.
Later in the program, we'll hear from South Central Indiana Housing Opportunities Executive Director Deborah Meyerson about next week's groundbreaking of a new affordable apartment project in Bloomington. That's coming up in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Darby McCarty talks about the history of Ellettsville in this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana. But first, your daily headlines.
The Indiana state budget passed through the state Senate this morning. As WFHB correspondent Graham Capito reports, the two-year budget includes increases for the beleaguered Department of Child Services.
Indiana's nearly $34.5 billion state budget was approved today by the state Senate. Indiana works on a biennial budget, meaning every 2 years the state legislature votes on allocating billions of dollars to the state's general fund. The 2020 to 2021 budget is nearly $3 billion more than the budget approved for this year and last year. It comes with a requested increase in funding for the Department of Child Services. The proposed increase comes as the number of children in out-of-home care continues to rise year after year. DCS's funding will increase roughly by a quarter in the next fiscal year, thanks to the new proposed budget. Along with an increase in funding, the legislature passed a measure regulating the caseload for DCS family case managers. The bill also increased the time a caseworker can spend with each case. The changes in funding and policy reflect the growing number of cases DCS has encountered in recent years. An assessment of DCS by the Child Welfare Policy and Practice Group reported a nearly 90% increase in the number of children in out-of-home child care from 2005 to 2017. That study cited the nationwide opioid crisis as a major contributor to the increase in children in state custody. Indiana is among the states hit hardest by the opioid crisis. Former Department of Child Services Director Mary Beth Bonaventura also cited the opioid crisis as a major burden for the agency. In her public resignation letter to Governor Eric Holcomb in 2017, Bonaventura also cited budgetary concerns and the strain of caseloads faced by the agency. The two-year budget bill, House Bill 1001, passed its third reading in the Senate today. The bill will now need to be reconciled with a similar Senate budget bill in conference committee over the next couple weeks. Once those bills are reconciled in conference committee, a final budget will be sent to Governor Holcomb to sign. For WFHB, I'm Graham Capito.
An Indiana Senate bill that would have legalized what has been dubbed loan shark lending, unquote, died on the House floor yesterday. Senate Bill 613 would have allowed payday and subprime lenders to charge interest rates on small loans to an extent that is currently classified as felony loan sharking in the state of Indiana. As reported by the Indy Star, the bill's support came from payday stores and installment loan shops. These groups hired lobbyists who said that the bill would provide consumers with more borrowing options. The bill was opposed by various consumer advocacy groups who said such practices constitute predatory lending. The Indiana Institute for Working Families have been organizing constituents and calling them to contact their legislators over the bill. The Republican-authorized bill passed the Senate in February despite opposition from both parties. However, the Republicans were unable to find enough supporters in the House yesterday before the deadline for a vote. The bill's sponsor, Republican Representative Matt Lehman, ultimately did not bring the bill up for vote yesterday.
The city of Bloomington will acquire the Bunger and Robertson property on South College Avenue, north of the Monroe Convention Center. The Bloomington Redevelopment Commission approved the $4.9 million purchase agreement in its meeting last night. Controller Jeff Underwood said the city anticipates closing the property on July 15th.
This would be a purchase of the building and most of the parking lot. There are two sections of the parking lot that are owned by others. However, we are continuing to negotiate through Bunger Robertson for the possibility of those two.
The two sections of the parking lot Underwood referenced are currently under a 10-year lease. He told the commission those leases would not preclude development on the rest of the property. The commission went on to approve a $6,000 contract with Tabor Bruce Architects to inspect the Bunger and Robertson property. Commission President Don Griffin asked City Attorney Larry Allen how the architecture firm was chosen.
Was this put out publicly, or did we just pick a architecture firm?
These are professional services, so we're not required to bid them out under the state law. So this is something that we can go to our preferred vendors for.
The commission also approved contracting with CSO Architects on the demolition of the city's 4th Street garage. The city has already contracted with the architecture firm for designs of a new 4th Street garage. In the same meeting, the commission approved a contract with Garmong Construction of Terre Haute to oversee the construction of the new Trades District garage.
Plans to put a 4-story boutique hotel with apartments near Bloomington's downtown Tech Park have run aground. Last night, the Bloomington Plan Commission denied Waterstone Bloomington Land LLC's hotel site plan for the northwest corner of Morton and 11th Street. Senior zoning planner Eric Grulich said the site plan did not adhere to a 2008 commitment made by the developer to include technology office space. Reviewing the project, Grulich said the proposed 4-story boutique hotel was one element of a larger project dubbed Morton North. The Plan Commission conditionally approved that mixed-use project in 2008. Then one component of the Morton North project resurfaced last December.
So this particular parcel had a condition of approval on it that dealt with a zoning commitment that gave the Plan Commission the ability to approve the site plan and land uses to make sure that what was happening here was in keeping with the Showers Technology Park and the goals of the comprehensive plan. And so this was heard at the December meeting last year, and the Plan Commission voted to continue this case to the February agenda in order to give the petitioner time to incorporate office uses or technology park uses within this project. Since then, nothing has changed with the development petition. They're still proposing ground floor commercial space with a hotel and then apartments on the upper floors. So the Plan Commission, as well as staff, felt like that was not in keeping with the zoning commitment that was required to ensure that the property developed with all of the goals of the city, the comprehensive plan, the Showers Technology Park.
Grulich also pointed to the city's significant investment in developing the tech park. The city has installed roads and hired a real estate broker to market parcels within it.
The architecture, the renderings for what has been submitted match everything that was previously shown and approved by the Plan Commission earlier. So it's just the use within the building that is the problem that does not, as I mentioned, align with the goals of the comprehensive plan as well as the zoning commitment that the petitioner signed and was aware of that required the uses within the building to be office and technology park oriented.
After some discussion, Plan Commission member Brad Whistler made the motion to deny the site plan.
I'll just say I think this is really unfortunate because I think this is a really nice building. It's well designed. I think it would, I hope it does get built at some point because I think if it fits well architecturally. I think the idea of having a boutique hotel in here makes a lot of sense, but I think it just is so obviously missing the employment center component that was just clearly and obviously part of the original agreement, and I can't in good conscience support it without that.
Commission member Nicholas Kappas said he agreed with Whistler. A plan including office space, he said, would have added value to the area.
What it currently is lack of parking for a lot of different tenants, and it would cause more strain on a trade district parking garage that's going in. So it was just, I was just very confused this entire time this was forward because it just was a hodgepodge of things put together. So I hope it comes back with a little bit more semblance of a plan instead of something that looks like it was piecemeal together.
Commission member Joe Hoffman said he also thought the situation was unfortunate. Referring to the 11-year-old zoning agreement, he pointed to the city's priority of a building with technology offices in it. He said, quote, "We never got that."
The city of Bloomington continues its environmental cleanup of its decommissioned Griffey Lake water treatment plant. Last night, the Bloomington Utilities Service Board approved extending its contract with VET Environmental Engineering for the cleanup. Assistant Director of Engineering Brad Schrader presented the contract.
Some of this is an outcome of we've kind of moved into cleanup phase on the grounds around the plant. So up until now, it's been mostly in the plant and emergency response. And this has kind of taken it outside and engaged with item and doing cleanup on that. So there's a tank removal and quite a few other things on that.
The city decommissioned the Griffey Lake water treatment plant in the 1990s. Schrader said the cleanup efforts originally began with asbestos removal. The utilities department undertook one mercury cleanup in 2017. The board hired VET for a second cleanup effort when new mercury contamination was discovered last year.
Then there's that with the mercury, there were flow meters and they weren't removed, and so the mercury, yeah, was broken and then spread all over by people moving through the building constantly and kind of distributed mercury everywhere. And that's part of what's in this and the following scope, which will come, is we found mercury even in other parts of the building where they finally were able to dewater it and get in there, and there is in fact mercury in those other parts of the building too. So there's mercury's proliferate.
Schrader said cleanup crews continue to discover more and more mercury. He said even small amounts can be hazardous.
It's in very small amounts, and when it gets into the concrete, it actually emits a detectable gas, which is hazardous. And that's why you can't go in without breathing protection, because it's everywhere and it's in the concrete. And even that little bit will emit a little bit of gas, so you have its exposure when you're inside.
Schrader said moving the toxic waste of the plant property has been a difficult and expensive endeavor because the asbestos and mercury are often mixed. He said the $230,000 VET contract extension will include waste hauling. Utilities Director Vic Kelson said he expects the cleanup will be completed in the next 3 months. Schrader added that the property will need long-term monitoring and its potential future uses still need to be worked out. The city would like to sell the plant eventually, but Kelson said he hasn't yet received a firm commitment from an interested party. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Todd Wicks.
And I'm Don Guerra. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. They are found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
South Central Indiana Housing Opportunities will break ground on a new affordable housing development in Bloomington's Switchyard Park next week. Executive Director Deborah Meyerson says Switchyard Apartments, located off of South Rogers Street, is made possible by a 99-year land lease from the City of Bloomington. WFHB News Director Wes Martin speaks with Deborah Meyerson in today's feature report.
SIHO, or South Central Indiana Housing Opportunities, will break ground on Monday on a new affordable housing development along Bloomington's Switchyard Park. The Bloomington-based nonprofit aims to expand and develop housing options for low to moderate income residents in South Central Indiana. SIHO Executive Director Deborah Meyerson says they also work in surrounding Brown, Owen, Green, Lawrence, and Morgan counties. Meyerson says the two-phase new affordable apartment complexes between South Rogers Road and the developing Switchyard Park are made possible by a generous land lease agreement with the City of Bloomington.
So the city acquired 65 acres for their Switchyard Park. And when we were looking at possibilities for new housing development, we were wondering if there might be something that could be part of that. And the city did indeed find its 0.6 acres that was not actually part of the actual park design, but was nonetheless part of the acquisition of the land. And so the city agreed under Mayor Hamilton and the Department of Parks and Recreation through the Board of Park Commissioners to do this under a 99-year ground lease. And so it's essentially donating the land, but the city still owns it, and we are leasing it, and we will be owning the actual building that we're building on it. But it's a great collaborative way to make a project like this work, because it costs money to build it, and it certainly it reduces the cost by having that agreement with the city and having the land donated under this ground lease. Well, we pay $1 per year for 99 years, so it's not literally free, but it's a nominal cost in terms of that collaborative approach. Any affordable housing project requires several layers of funding. It's just the way building it works, and so we're delighted to have several partners for this project, and so that includes both the project team and then for the financing. The financing has seven different sources, and that includes the Federal Home Loan Bank of Indianapolis. We received an Affordable Housing Program grant. We have the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority has, from their development fund, a loan that is a construction and to permanent loan, as well as Mutual Bank is our partner as well for another mortgage and construction loan. We also have money from the City of Bloomington that is partly allocated through the Home Investment Partnership Fund, which is federal money, but the city allocates, as well as the city's Housing Development Fund has also put money into this. We have a grant from Lowe's Charitable and Educational Foundation for some of the landscaping and interior upgrades, as well as we've used some of our NAP tax credits, which are Neighborhood Assistance Program tax credits, which means that donors can donate money to SIHO and the state gives them a tax credit. So it's kind of a win-win for donating to a nonprofit and supporting this project while also getting some reduction in taxes. So all those different sources have all helped support the production of this project. The Switchyard Apartments, we're building it in two phases. The groundbreaking on April 22nd is for phase one, which will be eight apartments of one- and two-bedroom units. It'll be two two-bedroom and six one-bedroom apartments, all for low-income residents for a variety of income levels, depending on eligibility. The groundbreaking is kind of a symbolic new construction start. We expect actual construction will probably start mid-May because we still have some permits that we're waiting on. We expect, based on discussion with the architect and the contractor, substantial completion by December 2019 and occupancy in first quarter 2020.
Meyerson says those who qualify for affordable housing need to make under a certain amount of the area median income. In Bloomington, where Switchyard Apartments will be built, SIHO looks at one-third of a family's income.
We need housing for all types of households, and honestly, there's a pretty big gap in this community between the average wages and housing prices, and that makes it hard for many households to truly be able to afford certain housing. And so being able to offer affordable housing means that we're really better able to have housing for all in our community, not just people who are lucky enough to be able to afford the market rates, but for people who work in our community or maybe don't earn enough of an income, or, you know, again, people with disabilities who are maybe not earning as much as a typically developing person might be able to earn. And we all need those accessible, affordable apartments in our community that really make us feel welcome and that we have a home here. The basic metric that's used for housing affordability is gauging 30% of one's income. No more than that should be allocated towards rent and utilities. In a case like this, if you're buying a home, it's a similar equation in terms of calculating that loan, but we're talking about rental apartments in this case. And so 30%, again, it's partly then also gauged on income levels. I mentioned the income eligibility for the apartment. So these apartments are reserved for people who earn between 50% and 80% of area median income, which is approximately $2,600 to $50,000 for the size family that could occupy these units. If you had a four-person family, that would be higher. But so that's the income level that is targeted with this. And actually, I should mention that three of the units are also reserved for clients of Life Design. So people with disabilities will have units that are made with their needs in mind, and Life Designs will be recruiting the tenants for and tenanting those units. But so it's reaching a range of affordability levels for a variety of households in the community.
The Switchyard apartment project will include two apartment buildings. On Monday, representatives from Bloomington and SIHO will break ground on the first apartment building near South Rogers Street. That three-story building will be joined later by a two-story apartment complex next to Switchyard Park. Together, the new affordable housing development will provide 16 one- and two-bedroom apartments reserved for those making a percentage of area median income.
We're just really excited to break ground on this project. We're really looking forward to it. It's in a terrific location. It's right next to Switchyard Park. And again, we just think that it's apartments that will really serve the community and serve people that want to live in a great place in Bloomington.
For WFHB, I'm Wes Martin.
You're listening to the Daily Local News on nonprofit, independent, community radio WFHB.
Coming up next, the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana.
Monroe County's Bicentennial Committee presents the Bicentennial Journal, stories celebrating the rich history of Monroe County.
My name is Darby Ann Earls McCarty, and this is a snapshot of my Ellettsville story. My grandfather owned Smithville Telephone Company Incorporated. He and my great-grandmother and my grandmother worked at the company. Smithville Telephone also worked for Public Service of Indiana, which is now Duke Energy. This was in 1950. I've been here ever since. My dad worked outside fixing phones, doing construction, or cutting brush, and my mother worked in the office taking care of customers. I was in the office as well. At the age of five, I would pick up the loose change on the floor and give it to my mom, grandmother, or great-grandmother. It was a good time for a five-year-old. The town grocery was called Constable's Grocery, and you could buy whatever you needed on account and pay it off once a week. I went to school at the Ellettsville High School Grade School. The gymnasium still stands and houses the charter school. School was fun. Teachers could hug or paddle you depending on what occurred. Everyone knew every kid in town, and that helped keep you safe. No locked doors. You could ride your bike even in the evening and not be afraid. You could wave and smile at people, and they would wave and smile back. Everyone was friendly back then. I had all of my grandparents and two great-grandparents. I was very fortunate to have the grands in my life. Highway 46 had beautiful maple trees that lined Temperance Street. It had a bit of a Mayberry feeling, and that was good. There was no school consolidation. All 12 grades went to the same building. Because we were growing, our teachers had to combine the 6th and 7th grades at the same time, with Westinghouse, Otis Elevator, and General Electric, Richland and Ellisville townships started to grow. People moved in from the east. Because of growth, Ellisville got a new sewer system, and that was so much better than a septic system in town. For entertainment, there was an open-air roller rink about 2 or 3 miles outside of town toward Bloomington. It was closed, of course, when the weather turned cold. There was a drive-in movie with G-rated movies, so everyone could pile in a car or truck and have a good time. Ellisville had grown from about 1,500 people to 4,500 people. The best entertainment was the Monroe County Fall Festival. Named entertainment would stop to perform as they were on their way somewhere else. My mother played piano for most of the acts. She was very talented that way. We had good local talent as well. It began with a church bell ringing and a prayer and ended with a prayer on Saturday night. Nothing interfered with church on Sunday. The festival was held in late September, and it was a total outdoor event. I don't recall the programs ever being canceled because of bad weather, however. Sometimes we were out there mopping off seats after the rain did fall. Back then, my family business was also the norm in a small town. Our business has the 4th and 5th generation working there now. The headquarters is still in Ellisville. Limestone is still a part of Ellisville. At one time, I had a great uncle that owned part of what is now Bybee Limestone Company today. Matthews Mill played a big part in Washington, D.C. architecture. I believe that was the name of the quarry before my great uncle was involved. Ellisville has had many unassuming people pass through and stay over Monroe County's 200 years. As Morris Enright would say, Ellisville's journalist, "Today, to God be the glory." And this is my story.
Join us next week for another edition of the Monroe County Bicentennial Journal.
Support for the Bicentennial Journal and WFHB comes from Monroe County and Visit Bloomington. More information about Monroe County's Bicentennial is available at monroecounty200.us.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Andrew McKieran and Graham Capito, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin.
The Bicentennial Journal is produced by Kate Welch with help from Joyce Poling. Our engineer is executive producer Wes Martin with help from Kevin Oliver. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Scott Schmidtke, and Danny Graff. For WFHB, I'm Todd Wicks.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at wfhb.org.
You, too, can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, please email news@wfhb.org.
Stay tuned for Counterspin, fairness and accuracy in reporting's weekly radio show, providing a critical examination of national headlines. That's coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a Daily Local News volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at wfhb.org and catch live broadcast of the Daily Local News Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.